like I'm an awfully gamble.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello, and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is Front Row Classics. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, and we are just rolling into 2021. We are here in the frozen tundra of Illinois, but you know what? Snowy days like this are the best time to watch classic movies, I think. It's the best time to just warm up with a feel-good movie, and we've definitely got a feel-good movie here today. We are talking about His Girl Friday from 1940, one of the all-time great screwball comedies of the 30s and 40s. And I have here, first of all, my co-host Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
It's cold. We're in the middle of a polar vortex with snow on the ground and more coming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we also have joining us for the first time in a couple months, our friend Brett Rutherford. Hey, Brett.
Hello there. Very excited to be here.
We were saying before the podcast, we just automatically have to have you on anytime we talk Rosalind Russell.
I think that's a good thing.
It is. And also joining us, and I couldn't believe it when I found out, but for the first time on Classics since she's been with the Front Row, Vanessa Ferguson.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here, and I hope I just don't embarrass you with my lack of knowledge, because I don't know anything about details of these old Hollywood movies.
That's fine.
I'm just here for the commentary.
Yes.
Yeah.
Learn.
I'm like, I literally listen to these podcasts and go, tell me a story, Brandon. And I just sit in my car and I listen to you and I learn things.
Yeah, I'm glad I have someone to impart my useless knowledge to. But
it's hardly useless. It's so interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. And I need to mention, Craig. You know, we have two of the three trifecta Beyond the Mouse here today.
You don't have to talk about him. He's dead to us. It's all about you guys now.
Who are you talking about?
Who's Craig?
He's already sent me private messages threatening me not to steal his co-host permanently. But we're just joining.
Oh, wow, that's a really nice thing. That couldn't have come from Craig.
But this
we
is
have
great.
His click already. Has there been enough time passed where his download counts? Because we want to make sure he stopped listening at this point.
Probably.
Oh, it's only fair. It's only fair.
You don't know what we live with. I'll blink twice if I want you to help me.
Well, that's fair. So we'll make sure that Craig doesn't feel too bad while listening to this. But just something to get this started with. This episode is actually our first listener request episode. We got an email back in December from a listener of ours named Erin Van Tassel, and she requested that we do this movie. So Erin, this is for you. And I decided to make it an extra special episode. And Beyond the Mouse is known for its witty banter, so I thought I would bring on two people who know witty banter very well.
So. Well, that's good.
Yep, there it is.
Great job. We're doing something right, Brett. We did it.
Actually, well, I thought that you brought us on because we are here to represent Beyond the Mouse because the character Endicott was played by Cliff Edwards, and we at Beyond the Mouse, of course, know him even better as the voice of Jiminy Cricket.
There is a
How's
Disney
that connection.
Yeah, there is a Disney.
So that's one of the reasons we're here.
And Pinocchio came out this same year, so he was busy in 1940.
He's busy.
Yeah.
See,
so
I'm learning. So, Brandon, tell me another story.
That was Brett. And that was your hello. Hello. Anyway, sorry.
We'll start with Eric here, though. Eric, do you want to give a plot synopsis first for His Girl Friday?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to keep this brief because it is a bit of a convoluted plot based on a play. And Brandon, before we started recording, I think you mentioned it, that they basically took 3 hours worth of movie and crammed it down into 90 minutes. So it's very fast paced, but it all revolves around our two main characters played by Cary Grant and the aforementioned Rosalind Russell. Rosalind is the character's name's Hildy, correct? And I don't remember the last name. Oh, Hildy Johnson. Yeah. And she's an ace reporter who's gone away and comes back to announce that she's getting married. She announces that to Cary Grant's character, Walter Burns, who's the editor of a New York newspaper and coincidentally is Hildy's ex-husband as well. Hildy announces she's going to be marry this man to take the train up to Albany, move there, have a new life, be what she says is a real woman. And we get a plot that centers around an impending execution. And this is a news story that Hildy can't turn down. So she gets sucked into covering this news story, and a lot of the action takes place centered around that and the press room in the courthouse where this prisoner is going to be executed the next day. The prisoner ends up escaping, and there's a couple of different plot twists after the prisoner escapes. The resolution is that he's eventually caught, but granted clemency by the governor, and Hildy ends up just kind of forgetting about her fiance, leaving him to actually rot in jail because of a plot that Cary Grant's character put together, and they end up getting back together. And instead of having their honeymoon for 2 weeks in Niagara Falls, they decide they're going to go to Albany and actually cover a case there too. So that's it in a nutshell. A whole lot of plot twists between A and B though.
So Vanessa, we will start with you. What was your first impression of His Girl Friday?
Oh, my first impression is, if you are ever unsure about watching older black and white films, maybe that's not something you're totally into, start with this one because it is so fun and so fast paced. I don't think I've ever laughed so hard in the first like 15 minutes of a black and white film. It was so funny. Not only are the lines delivered quickly and delivered really well, but the lines are written really well. They're very funny lines. I really liked it. I liked the story. There's a lot of kind of feminist undertones in the story, which I really liked as well. So I just thought it was a great film. And I'm glad to hear that a lot of people think that way too. And if you haven't seen it, then you definitely should.
Brett?
Well, you know, I am a fan of classic films and black and white films. And it was hard to believe. I knew of this film, but I just kind of, I don't know, oh, well, I'll get around to it, you know, that sort of thing. And oh my gosh, I am in love with this movie. I mean, it's going to the top, you know, my top five black and white films. Not that there's really a difference, but you know, I'm like, anyway. I have it up there in my classics anyway. I was blown away on first viewing and then second viewing. And this, I mean, this bodes well for future viewings because it is so jam-packed and filled with dialogue, as we said, but so many interesting things. I was blown away.
Yep. Eric?
Yeah, it had been a long time since I had seen this one. And I'll be honest too, there were parts of it that I didn't remember, and I sort of got it a little bit confused with Bringing Up Baby, which is kind of a similar screwball comedy. I think maybe made just a couple of years earlier.
There's no leopard in this one though.
yeah. And Bringing Up Baby is definitely like the wackier of those two films. And I forgot this movie's certainly funny. I don't think it's as funny as Bringing Up Baby, but I think that it is more poignant. There are so many subtextual themes to this that are way more important in this movie that I caught onto and grabbed a hold of, I think, a little bit more this time, because I knew the jokes. I knew the jokes that were coming. But then to see, because it's so fast paced, to see all the other things that are going on, it's almost worth it to view this one a second time.
Oh, definitely. And Brett, you mentioned it. This is based off of the play The Front Page, which was then made into the movie The Front Page in 1931, where Walter Burns and Hildy Johnson are two men in the original source material. And Howard Hawks, the director, who, Eric, you and I just talked about a movie of his a few months ago, The Big Sleep, which this has similar aspects to, definitely. But he had the brilliant idea. They were at a party and they were talking about great dialogue, and he pulled out his copy of The Front Page and just had people read lines from it. And he had one of his secretaries read the lines for Hildy Johnson, and he said, "I like those lines coming out of a woman's mouth." And he said, and he had been trying to get Columbia to finance a remake of The Front Page for a while. And so he made the brilliant choice to do that. And he went to get permission from Charles MacArthur, the playwright, to do that. And he said, "I can't believe we didn't think of it." So he, so not only did he get permission, but I think he made the source material even better, because you're right, Eric, there's a poignancy to it being a divorced couple, and there's something about bringing the love triangle aspect into it, and something about being a really, making Hildy a really independent woman, because they don't even question the fact that she is a female in this most of the time. It's she's the best reporter in the field out there, and they never question that once. So it's definitely a movie that was ahead of its time and does get better on repeat viewings, I think. So let's start out with talking about the actual characters. And just because he's top billed, we'll start with Cary Grant as Walter Burns. And Brett, we'll start with you this time. What are your thoughts on Cary Grant in this film?
Well, you know, you were saying that this was somewhat similar in tone to Bringing Up Baby. And you said that there was no what was the animal?
A leopard.
There was no leopard, but there was plenty of cattiness in this. Ha ha, there's the witty banter for you. Sorry. No, but when I was watching this, I was referencing Philadelphia Story, you know, this, you know, mm-hmm. And so again, it's kind of, I don't know, are we slotting Cary Grant into kind of that character? I mean, you know, each movie certainly has its own merits, but, you know, but he's just wonderful in all of them. So how about that? So, you know, he was just so good. What I really enjoyed, I enjoy watching characters in movies and in plays and in any sort of entertainment like that. I like watching them think. And he, you know, there's a lot of times where, you know, it is so, the dialogue is so quick that you don't see that process, but you see the calculations and kind of, you know, how he's going to get her back into his life when they go out to lunch, you know? And so you get to see him plotting and planning in his head. And I just enjoyed that. So, yeah. And then, you know, he just let loose. It didn't take him very long to think about everything he needs to do to get her back as a reporter, maybe even to his life as well.
Yep. Eric?
Yeah, and Brandon, you mentioned that Cary Grant's got top billing, and he's good in this film. I just want to say that at this point, though, Rosalind Russell should have top billing, because she's the main character, she's the title character, and she's also in more of this movie. You know, there's a large chunk where the middle of this part of this movie, Cary Grant kind of disappears. His character doesn't have much to do. When he's on screen, though, he's doing what he does very, very well. He's charming. He's witty. He's quick. Cary Grant had a background in vaudeville where he was coming up with lines on the spot. They're doing that in this movie. There's an electricity between him and Rosalind Russell. So I love this performance. He's so hard to pin down because he's so funny, but he's also a leading man that he's just so good at so many different things and makes it look effortless too.
Absolutely. Vanessa?
Well, Cary Grant himself, I know Cary Grant from his older work where he's a little bit older gentleman. So when I started watching this, I was like, oh, who is this handsome man at the beginning of this movie? And I'm like, this is Cary Grant. Oh, my. So he himself, I thought he was wonderful. I really like his delivery. You can tell he has the comic chops to deliver some of these lines, especially so quickly. The character himself, I struggle with because he's so manipulative, and yes, I'm very much attracted to that. But then I think, no, bad Vanessa, bad, your therapist would not like that. Do not go after that. And I'm like, Hildy, no, but Hildy kind of, yes, want you to, but Hildy, no, don't do it. So I was found myself conflicted throughout the film, wanting them to get together, not wanting them to get together. And the manipulative this is just, it's a lot. He calls her selfish at one time, and I, you know, grasp my pearls. So it's
just... and he's a narcissist, right? I mean, he's totally just in it for himself.
I don't, so like the narcissist of narcissists, they don't have any kind of empathy for anybody else. They don't understand other people's feelings. So I can't tell if he's a full-on narcissist or if he's just very manipulative, but like also in a very handsome, charming, oh, it's okay to manipulate me way. Like, I kind of like it. I kind of don't. I mean, don't tell my therapist any of this. This would be just, it's just terrible to report back.
This is fiction. This is a film. You can differentiate. So it's all good.
There's a great documentary on the Blu-ray I was watching where Molly Haskell, who's a film critic, she said, all of these great independent women in the 40s and 30s stuck to their guns until they got with Cary Grant. And then they stopped being independent.
I mean, I can see how that would happen.
But he's a... it's true. The character of Walter Burns does not change in this movie. He's the same at point B as he was at point A. He doesn't have any kind of arc. But I think that's great because Cary Grant could play anything. He could be a suave leading man. He could be a nerdy kind of character like he is in Bringing Up Baby. And he could be kind of a narcissist, you know, but he does it with such charm that you really don't mind almost, just because he is this sort of larger than life likable figure. But he can do rapid fire dialogue so well, and I don't know that any other leading man of that era could pull it off that well. But I just, what I always appreciate about Cary Grant is he never, as big of a star as he was, he never had enough ego to where he didn't mind sharing the spotlight with somebody. And he gives the floor to Rosalind Russell so much in this movie, and you can tell that they're having fun. And one thing that I pick up on whenever I watch old interviews with any of these leading ladies from the 30s and 40s, whenever they talk about Cary Grant, they always say, boy, did we have fun. And you can just tell that was the atmosphere of this movie, because a lot of directors of that time were very stringent about sticking to the script and everything, but Hawks encouraged people to go off script and to add things. So you could tell they all had such leeway and they were all just having fun with each other.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, and you were saying, and in my research here, you know, I was coming into this knowing about it, but, you know, seeing it with very, very fresh eyes. So now doing a little bit of behind the scenes research is both helpful and hurtful. That, you know, that apparently, you know, Cary Grant, because of his, as you said, Eric, because of his vaudeville background, he was, you know, very quick-witted and could come up with things very quickly. But Rosalind Russell needed to hire a friend of a friend, well, you know, an advertising person to write her banter, which, you know, anyway. But, hey, got the job done. And actually, her jabs were pretty good. So.
Oh, they were good. And, yeah. And apparently, Cary Grant would always ask her when she got to the set the next morning, so what do you got for me today?
Yeah. That's okay. Yeah. That's fun.
So let's move on then to talking about Rosalind Russell as Hildy Johnson. And we'll start with you, Vanessa.
Oh, I love her. Like, I love her. First of all, as soon as she walks in with that striped like chevron outfit, stunning, and the hat, I need that outfit. But then when she comes in and she's, you know, she's just so fast with the dialogue. I mean, we were talking before we started recording about when she's going, she's talking over Cary Grant and going like, you know, sold America. And it's, I can't even say it. It's so quick. And to do that and come up with these funny lines. I mean, these lines are funny, but you have to deliver them in such a way that it's comical. Like when she says something like, I'm bashing your monkey skull and until the gong chimes, like, it's, I don't know. I don't have it. I don't have it like she has. She's got the X factor. I don't. So she's just so perfect in this. And like, if there ever was a leading lady to really embody independence and confidence, and you know, one of my favorite scenes in this movie is when she walks in with the press gentleman, and she is one of them. She does not cower down. She takes up the space that she needs to take up unapologetically. And I love all the scenes that she's in. I mean, I think you're right, Eric. It should be, you know, she should get top billing, because this movie, without her, I don't know what it would be. This movie for me is all about her.
Eric?
Yeah, and I love how you portray her, Vanessa. I mean, there's no doubt when she walks into that press room that she's one of the guys. In fact, they kind of defer to her because that character is so good at her profession. And throughout the movie, most of the characters say nobody can write it like she can. I mean, she's an expert in her field, and Rosalind Russell has this strength that she can carry that off. And at the same time, she has that ability to banter so well with Cary Grant that could be the whole movie. I mean, there really doesn't have to be anything else. It's just the two of them talking over each other with this witty banter. You don't need anything else, but you get a whole lot more. And then you get a lot more from her too, in these sort of really soft moments as well. I mean, she's the only character. She doesn't really have a great A to B either, but she does learn some lessons along the way. And she allows herself to be vulnerable at the same time being manipulative when she's talking with the death row inmate. And it's just it's a great turn. And there's very, very few people I can imagine in this role other than her.
Yeah, Brett?
We've talked about how wonderful she is with Cary Grant. But one of the scenes that I really, really enjoy that kind of sets the tone initially is her when she comes in with Bruce Baldwin to make this big announcement to her ex-husband that she is leaving and all of that. You know, the way she talks to Bruce, you know, I think is just very sweet, and it kind of, it mirrors the relationship that they have, you know, and maybe that is why she wants something different, is because she gets to have a softer side. It's a nice kind of quality that she has there, in contrast to the rat-a-tat-tat dialogue that she has with her ex-husband. So I enjoyed that scene, but she's just amazing. And to think, you know, I don't know if we're going to get into this, but some of the other actresses that they were considering, and that she was one of the, you know, this is who you have. And, you know, maybe Carol Lombard, you know, which I guess was one of the first choices.
It was written for Carol Lombard.
But the others, I'm just like going, no. They landed right with where they needed to. With, she's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting time in Rosalind Russell's career, because she had been sort of pigeonholed as kind of this dramatic actress, which she didn't enjoy in the 30s. And then the year before, in 1939, she comes out with The Women and steals the show from Joan Crawford and Norma Shearer in that movie. And then her contract is up at MGM. So now she's freelancing, and this is her next thing. But this movie was written for Carol Lombard, and they couldn't afford her or something at that point. And then Katharine Hepburn turned it down. Irene Dunne turned it down. Jean Arthur turned it down. Ginger Rogers turned it down. So there were...
Sorry. I'm just having a gut reaction to the idea of Ginger Rogers doing this. I'm sorry. Go back to dancing.
This was the point after Ginger had left Fred and wanted to be a dramatic actress, but yeah, it didn't work out all that well.
No.
But she was like seventh, eighth choice, and she kind of plays this movie like she's got nothing to lose. And mm-hmm. I think that that's what helps her performance. And you're right. I love the huge fast paced moments, but it's those quiet moments. Like after this first scene with Molly Malloy and all the press guys, she's the only one who can relate to Molly on a kind of emotional level. And when Molly leaves and she comes back in, she just does that quiet gentleman of the press kind of mm-hmm. line. It's so brilliantly played.
So good.
Mm-hmm. And I just love too, like the transformation that she has when she's hanging out with those gentlemen, because she comes in with this, she's dressed so well this entire movie, as Vanessa pointed out earlier, and she's got this hat that matches the suit that she's wearing throughout the middle part of the film. And slowly as she is around those press guys, the brim of that hat just folds up like the classic old school, you know, press, you know, you can almost see the little ticket that says press sticking out of that thing that transforms herself into that too. It's just it's a great physical transformation.
I like it here in classics. I'm just noticing things now. I'm like, oh, you're so
right.
I didn't notice that.
That's so cool. Well, also her physical comedy, because speaking of her coat and her hat, when she gets, there's the part where, you know, she gets a little, well, she gets very busy and she wears my hat, and she's wearing the hat and her coat, and she's putting in the sleeve in the wrong. I mean, that is just comedy.
And the telephones too,
gold.
Right?
She uses props so well. I miss rotary phones because they make such a good prop, mm-hmm. and you can do so much with them. But the scene where she's dodging all of the motorcycle cops, and it's so brilliantly done. And of course, that's a stunt double who tackles the guy at the end of that. But still,
illusions are just torn away.
But it's wonderfully done. There's plenty of scenes to talk about later, but let's talk about the third person in this trifecta, and that's Ralph Bellamy as Bruce. And Ralph Bellamy became an archetype. He always played the sad sack third wheel in these kind of movies. He did a great performance a couple years later in another great screwball comedy called The Awful Truth with Cary Grant and Irene Dunne, and he plays second fiddle to Cary Grant in that as well. And he became the Ralph Bellamy type, it sort of became, and he plays it so great. And this is a guy who acted all the way. His last movie role was in Pretty Woman in 1990 when he was in his mm-hmm. 80s, and he's so there's something so likable about him, but it's just hard to root for him sometimes because he's such a sad sack. But Eric, we'll start with you. What are your thoughts on Ralph Bellamy?
Yeah, and there's something about his physicality and his face that you just believe this guy sells insurance and is like really into it. Like everybody knows somebody like that who's like, hey, I really want to talk to you about some insurance products. And you're like, no, I don't want that. And it's like they nailed it with this character. All the bad things in the movie happen to him. And you still don't want to root for the guy because he is just this sad sack. Just well played, well written, fun character.
Yeah, Brett.
Because I was familiar with him from Pretty Woman. So when to see this extremely younger version of this, I'm like going, I had to kind of connect the dots a little bit, or eight spots or whatever. But anyway, I won't try as hard. So I had to kind of like completely like kind of flip my switches to, you know, who this is and in a new light. So I really enjoyed it. But I'm like going, his lines, I'm like going, well, Hildy, we could take the 6 o'clock train if it could save a man's life. You know, I'm like you know, and he said it so genuinely, like, you know, and then he just, you know, thought of that. I'm like going, oh, give him props for that. So that was good. So, and he was just the foil to all of, you know, all of the nastiness that Cary Grant, you know, has in store for him in order to things, you know, he's probably never been in a jail cell before until, you know, this. So yeah, that was funny.
Yeah. Vanessa.
So why is there evolved Vanessa? was rooting for him, actually. And I was like, come on, Hildy, go for him. He's safer. Go for until she's like, and I've got a third ticket for my mother. I'm like, dump him. Just dump him. This is not going to work out for you, sister. He's always going to side with mom. And then it kind of turns out that way, that the only time he really starts to get aggravated with her is when his mom is involved. And I'm like, leave him. Not worth your time, honey.
Isn't that one of Cary Grant's lines too, where he says something like, of course there's a mother, and he does it with this sort of smirk.
Well, and the thing Ralph Bellamy, his rhythm is, you know, everybody has that kind of chop choppy rhythm, and his rhythm is so, you know, clear and smooth. And I read that Howard Hawks told him, and a couple of other, the guy who plays Earl Williams and a couple other people, he said, the sophisticated people talk fast, the unsophisticated people speak slowly. So
well we better speak much faster. There we are.
I am so mid-Atlantic, and we will so just, much, you know, better.
Well, someone says in order to be funny you have to speak faster, so I will continue to speak faster. I don't know.
Well, there are tons of great character parts and small roles in this movie that we can talk about. What and I'll just go around. Vanessa, what's one that sticks out to you?
Okay, hold on. I have to find his name, but where did you go, sir? He's so silly. He's silly. He's a silly guy.
Oh, yes.
Joe Pettibone.
Yes.
What is up with that guy? He's just like giggling and going woo in very strange moments. And I can't keep my eyes off of him every time he comes into the scene. He's just hilarious.
He does speak slowly, so we know what category he's in. So.
He's an actor named Billy Gilbert, and that was his shtick. That's what he did.
Also, a Disney connection there as well. So he voiced, I believe he was the voice of Sneezy the Dwarf in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Aww.
Yeah, and then the giant in Mickey and the Beanstalk as well. Oh. So.
Well, no wonder why we're here, Vanessa. Yeah. Look at all of this. That's,
Vanessa Disney was history. Just immediately engaged with him because of that.
I am. I'm drawn to those Disney people, you know?
Yeah. How cool.
That's one of my favorite part at the end when he's trying to give the picture of his wife out to the mayor. And the mayor goes, yeah, she's a lovely woman. Oh, you haven't seen her yet.
I'm like going, well, she's good enough for me, you know, or something like that. I'm like going,
and when he's trying to
get my wife, ooh.
And when he's trying to get through the door with the umbrella. Yeah.
Yes.
Brett, what's a character role that stuck out to you?
Well, I think it was interesting. I mean, I don't know, given our current sort of political atmosphere and press versus politics and all this, I did find that relationship and with its truths and non-truths and all that. But anyway, I found that the mayor was so two-faced and so slimy and so, you know, the way he turns, especially at the end, from, you know, we're arresting you and, you know, all this sort of stuff to, oh, well, why do you have handcuffs on these kind people? I'm just like going, it was probably a little closer to life than we'd really hope it would be, but it was an interesting, interesting take.
And that, when I watched it this time, I'm like, man, this movie stays relevant.
Yes.
And what I also know, I mean, and I was going to talk about this later, but like in terms of the press, nobody is trying to be, nobody is trying to stay objective about anything. There's so much fake news going on.
Yeah. When they're all, you know, yes, that was sad. But they kind of, in the prologue, sort of, in the opening images, you know, they kind of say, well, this is the way it used to be, but it's not like that now.
Yeah.
You know.
Don't be so sure.
Well, once upon a time, you know. Yeah. So. Yeah.
Eric, who's a small character that stuck out to you?
There were two that I really wanted to make sure that we hit. Mm-hmm. And the first was Gene Lockhart as the sheriff, who's really good as this bumbling idiot of a sheriff who's also himself not above corruption and bending some rules to get his agenda done. And his agenda definitely involves the Earl Williams character. And I thought played really, really well by John Quaylen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is a a character that I think we see in, it's almost like a stereotype of this person maybe wrongly convicted or convicted of something greater than what they did, and the punishment doesn't exactly fit the crime, but we're not real sure because the character is so quiet and timid and sort of inept, but he also pulls a gun on people. So, I mean, it's tough to pull that off, the balance between a guy who doesn't come across as a killer, but very well could be. And I thought that was one of those moments of poignancy that's played very well by that actor.
And he has great comedy moments too, you know, yeah. when he's stuck in the desk, I'm like going, are you okay? A little more air, please, you know, or something like that.
So. Yeah, I love that. And Cary Grant just waves a few wafts of air and then it shuts the desk. Yeah. Vanessa, you were saying.
Yeah, when he says, like, I felt so sorry for him when he's like, oh, I don't smoke. I'm like, he's innocent, you guys. He's so sweet. Like, he can't be guilty. And just my heart broke every time that he was in a scene. And it actually, his character is what made me a little confused about whether this was a comedy or a drama, because I was so taken with his sincerity that I'm like, is this a drama, really? I mean, I know it's funny, but that has some very kind of heavy moments to it.
Yeah, there's some poignancy. And I, the one person I was going to bring up, I mentioned her earlier, but Helen Mack, who plays Molly Malloy, I think she gives a very poignant performance in this. I mean, this is a heavy-duty comedy, but to have somebody jump out a window, she doesn't die, thank goodness. But, you know, she really brings pathos. And she's one of the reasons you really care about Earl Williams, I think, is she brings the humanity to that part as well. But, you know, they can't really in 1940, I guess you couldn't really make reference to the fact that she's a prostitute, but that's obviously what she is. But she is that stereotypical hooker with a heart of gold. But I think that that could have definitely been a stereotypical role, but I don't think she makes it stereotypical. I think she really brings a lot of pathos to that.
When she also calls out the reporters. I mean, just tells it, this is what you're doing. And these are people's lives. And, you know, this is not good, you know? So, yeah.
And I definitely think that corruption that we talked about a little bit between the press and the government officials, it's definitely a theme that carries weight today. But there's also this sort of really early look at mental health and, you know, what constitutes, you know, society's impact on the crimes that somebody commits. And then you have this other Molly Malloy character who's willing to commit suicide for this other individual. I mean, and it's really unexpected for a screwball comedy to have those weighty type things, those weighty themes permeate throughout this.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. Let's move on and talk about, though, our favorite scenes or favorite lines of dialogue that stick out to us. Eric, I'll start with you. What's a favorite moment of yours?
You know, I really do love the ending of this movie, though. And I think that it's the moment where Rosalind Russell kind of breaks down and cries and realizes that she doesn't want the traditional American housewife sort of role and wants to be a reporter. And I think that's what she wants to be. I don't think she wants to be Cary Grant's wife necessarily. I love that. It's the moment where you realize this character's getting what they want. And it also is like, that's pulling the feminist thread and tying all of that together. So I really think that's a great scene in this movie.
Yeah, Brett?
Well, you know, kind of piggybacking on that, the example that she had is, you know, I mean, she's in the middle of typing her story. So, and Bruce is, you know, leaving. And she says, you know, if you want me, Bruce, just take me as I am instead of changing me into something else. I'm no suburban bridge player. I'm a newspaper man, you know. I'm just like, yeah. And it's rat-a-tat-tat.
Great line.
One line. And she's typing. So this is how I really feel, because I'm really busy talking about something or writing something else.
Yeah. And the thing that gets me about the ending is There's no embrace. They don't kiss like you would at a, you know, at the end of a big Hollywood movie. It's very, you know, he makes her carry her own suitcase down the stairs. And I always wonder, I'm like, is their relationship doomed to end the way it did in the beginning? Are they going to eventually just split again?
But, I give them 3 weeks.
Yeah. But, and yet she's just not the type of person that would settle down. She likes the thrill of the chase too much. So it's just going to be a big cycle with the two of them, I think. It's going to just constantly be, oh, I love you, oh, I hate you. But yeah, Brett.
There's also another line that I was impressed with. The mayor is asked, what effect will this have on any of the voters? Because there's a big election coming up. None whatsoever. How can an unavoidable misfortune like this have an influence on the upright citizens of our fair city? You know, I'm like going, oh, does that sound familiar? Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, so again, relevance from a film from 1940. Sorry.
40, yep. Yep. Vanessa, what's a moment that stuck out to you?
Well, I really liked in the beginning when she's, you know, telling him that she's going to get married. And he says, like, basically says, yeah, we're divorced, but that doesn't mean anything. I mean, we're till death do us part still. And then, and that really carries through even to the end for me when they're handcuffed together. It's like, you know, they don't really want to be handcuffed, but they are together. And then it, like, very symbolic of, yep, we're divorced, but we're still here together. Yep, we're handcuffed, but we're going to be together. And then as they exit together, of course, is so perfect. So I just kind of really liked those moments because I think all of us have some past relationships where we feel like, man, I'm going to be bumping into you for the rest of my life, aren't I? You know? So it was done in a very kind of comical way instead of what could be depressing for some. So.
I love the when they're handcuffed together and he says, it's okay, Hildy, we've gotten out of bigger scrapes than this, haven't we? And she just says, nope. Yeah, but I think my favorite scene, though, is the scene in the restaurant between Grant, Bellamy, and Russell. And it's apparently like they had scheduled 2 days to shoot that, but it took 4 days because they just kept adding. And there's so much, you know, stuff going on, you know, so much subtext, so much, you know, bits with the waiter and everything. And I love, because Cary Grant is just plotting the whole time and nothing he says is at face value at all in that scene. There's so much going on and it's played brilliantly. You know, there's so much. And what got me this time was this movie was meta before meta was a thing, because Cary Grant has the line when he's talking to one of the gangster malls saying, oh, he looks like that guy in the movies, Ralph Bellamy.
Yes, I know. Yeah, I love that. I love that.
So. And there was another reference to his birth name, too, correct? Like he mentions
Archie Leach.
Which is him, right? That's his.
Yeah, that's his real name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cary Grant was born Archibald Leach. So, and then there's a couple of moments where they even look at the camera and say lines. There was another line that I didn't realize was an in line, but when Earl Williams is in the desk and he says, get out of there, you mock turtle, or whatever, Cary Grant had played the mock turtle in a live action version of Alice in Wonderland a few years before. So they were just throwing in all these kind of bits. Gosh.
You know, they're having fun if they can do that, you know, and they're at the top of their game. So
yeah. Very impressive. Any other scenes or characters that stick out to you?
You know, I did want to say that there is also this sort of pervasive theme about the Red Menace and communism in the United States as well. And, you know, it's kind of this is 1940. This is before the United States entered World War II. And it's kind of funny that they have this moral high ground, you know, at this point in America's history, and you know, we're sort of better than these communist countries, and that even goes further throughout World War II. And then at the same time, you have these officials who are willing to execute a man just so that they can gain the votes for the election that's coming up next Tuesday.
It's amazing how in 1940 we were so the Russians were so much in our forethought in Moscow and everything, and as you mentioned the dialogue, Hitler was kind of treated as a joke, and you know, a year
take Hitler and put him in the funny pages, you know,
and then a year later that would be reversed on its forehead. Gee. but that's just the whole history of that is pretty
there's
amazing.
Also there's a race issue here, which mm-hmm. seems to
yeah,
be
yeah I'm glad you brought that up,
which is just kind of mentioned as a matter of fact, but it's just said, you know, that the Earl Williams character, I mean, it's clearly he is out of his mind. His the arresting officer was, you know, now we of course would say, you know, black or African American, but they you know, said colored, and it just was, well, of course, now I understand why, you know, and it was about the vote,
and they talk about how important the African American vote was.
And it was just, you know, done in a second. And it was kind of, it was code. It was something that everyone, oh, well, you know. And I'm just like going, wow, it's hard to watch. And with some other films I've been watching recently too, I'm just kind of, it's very hard to watch some of these with like either misogynistic or racist, you know, undertones that are just given, you know, just, you know, taken for granted. So anyway, I just felt that it's just very sad, you know, but we've moved on. So,
but in terms sort of how this film views women or Hildy's character, that's what one thing I really liked about this film is I think it really holds up because she is treated so equally. Some like after this, I watched To Catch a Thief because I'm like, oh, Brandon's got me on this trail of classic movies. He's going to tell me all these stories,
which we're talking about in May, by the way.
Okay. Well, there is a woman gets slapped in that movie. And I was just like, oh, this is so different from His Girl Friday that I've just watched. Like Hildy would never be slapped. And if she was slapped, she would punch back, I think, because she threw her purse at him. And
I know, but there are a couple of times in her dialogue, in her rat-a-tat dialogue, where she kind of alludes, there were at least two times where she alludes to the fact that she might have been slapped a little bit around too, but she just counts it off as nothing, you know.
But that's what's interesting. But that's what's interesting. Female characters in the 30s and 40s were really very strong. I mean, because you had the Betty Davises and the Joan Crawfords and the Rosalind Russells. And then in the 50s, you kind of regressed a little bit in terms of women. So like, and it's like you might see women getting slapped in a 50s movie, whereas, you know, some of these women in the 40s, you know, they might have been, but they would have slapped back and they wouldn't have stood for it. Yeah. But so it's really like interesting that. To see how, yeah.
Well, hello. Well, the other thing, you know, okay. I'm in the minority.
I was supposed
here.
To say that. Well, hello. Sorry.
Oh, right. Sorry. Oh, okay. Well, okay. Sorry. Well, insert well, hello here. Anyway. Okay. I'm in the minority here because when we get to the end, you know, she's had this emotional breakdown, which I thought you cared and all this. And it's kind of her, she does love him and all this, but she's back to square one, which is not necessarily the most feminist view. If, you know,
true.
She does have, you know, she knows what she wants now, I think probably a little bit more because she is such a natural in this world. You know, when she heard gunshots and when she heard the fire alarm and all this, you know, well, that sounds like a good story. Well, I'm not doing that, but that sounds like a good story. But she goes back to where she started, which I don't know, that's somewhat unsatisfactory to me. That's a slightly you know, sad ending for her, for someone who is so strong. But I know that she will bounce back and maybe she'll get her Niagara Falls at some point. Just tell them we're going.
There does seem to be like a twinge of sadness when she's like, oh, we're going to Niagara. Oh, you're going to have someone watch the paper. Oh, we're going. Oh, well, yeah, I guess we can do work.
Cover that
and
strike.
And it's like, you see this joy just slowly fade.
You know,
and I'm like
going,
cause they're first,
but she's okay with it. I'm like going,
I don't
lady,
know
you've
she
been
is.
So strong. Gosh.
I think she's a little sad, but she's just kind of like, I accept it, but not fully happy. But
yeah, well, because their first honeymoon was ruined. Because their first honeymoon was ruined because of a coal mine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think she just figures, you know, anything that we plan is going to be, because there's always a breaking news story somewhere.
Yeah.
But I think that's what I like about this ending, is that there is some interpretation to how all of those things fit together and how that that Hildy Johnson character, you know, where were they before and was that the right place for them to be? And then I think it's a lot of opinion on whether you think they're right. And then, you know, Vanessa mentioned it too, that characters don't always make the choices that are in their best interest. Vanessa doesn't always chase the good guy. Sometimes she goes after the bad guy, yeah, you know,
I keep my therapist, you know, well paid. Because of these things. Yes, this is true. Thank you, Eric.
Well, and even and as I thought about it, even the title of this movie is an ironic title that's open to interpretation, because she's not his Girl Friday. She is, you know, she's very independent and she's his star reporter. So it's, you know, he might think of her that way. But
the guy that he keeps calling back at the press office is more his Girl Friday.
It is, yeah.
The I don't even know the role that guy has, but he's the one that's doing all the grunt work.
Mm-hmm. He knows what's going on. It's fun. He knows what's going on when they're all talking. When Cary Grant's character is talking to Bruce Baldwin, you know, he's kind of setting him up, and he goes, "Yeah, well, here he goes," and all this sort of stuff. But the other thing is that Rosalind Russell knows her ex-husband. So, you know, get the check, get the certified check, put it in your hat. You know, I need your money, because she knows what's going on there too, that'll happen. Yeah, so
especially in that lunch scene when she catches him lying about the twins, she doesn't get upset by it. She's just kind of that's gotcha. Him. She's so used to it. She's just like, I figured it out. I would be like, so mad. You lied about twins? But, you know, she knows what to expect.
Yeah. Funny.
Another character I love that I didn't point out, I do love the two scenes with Bruce's mother, played by Alf, because she storms in and she takes over for those two scenes that she has. But yeah, she gets, I don't want to know what happens to her when Louie, you know, picks her up and carries her when she gets roughed up somewhere. But one of the things though I wanted to focus on though, we talked about the overlapping dialogue, but it's so unique to this movie. It's like you really have to, this isn't a movie that you can sit and just play on your phone while you watch. You have to really pay attention, and Howard Hawks wanted that to be a trademark of this film, and they specifically wrote the beginnings and endings of lines as throwaway so that they wouldn't matter, because lines would overlap so much, because he said this is how people talk in real life. People talk over one another. And apparently, instead of using an overhead boom mic like they would in those days, they put little microphones all around so that they would pick up, and they would have literally have a technician who would switch mics during the thing. And they said apparently one setup took 35 switches at one point.
Yeah, because you couldn't have all the sound go into a mixing board like you can today. That's an amazing technical achievement.
I was watching this. It was a featurette on Turner Classic Movies with Ileana Douglas, who I did not know was Melvin Douglas's daughter, granddaughter. Anyway, a relative. Anyway, that she was telling Carol Burnett, who was on that as well, said that Howard Hawks had a metronome going, that, you know, to keep the pace up with the dialogue, which actually gives me, are you ready for your question? So this is my question.
Yeah.
Do we know, have we heard if Robert Altman was influenced by this film? Because he was famous for having multiple conversations going on at the same time. And I was trying to do a little research to see if, you know, if this was kind of an aha or a light bulb moment for him.
I thought of Altman, and I thought of Aaron Sorkin when I thought of this movie, because Aaron Sorkin's dialogue is so reminiscent of that. And Craig will be happy that I mentioned Aaron Sorkin.
He stopped listening.
Craig,
40
Craig?
Minutes ago. But
this is Craig.
And then also Quentin Tarantino has said that this is one of his all-time favorite films as well. So it has a long, long pedigree. And also I read as well, when they were getting ready to shoot Clue, the movie in 1985, Jonathan Lynn, the director, sat the cast down and showed them His Girl Friday. And he said, no, I'm not saying you have to talk this fast, but I want to show you that you can talk this fast and people will still understand you. So
Wow, that's cool. Ooh, I love this. See, Vanessa, we learned so much.
I know. I'm like taking notes for the quiz later. No,
I do get points for Robert Altman, don't I, please?
Oh, no. That's a great pull. And I had written that down on my notes here, too, because that is, there's definitely a direct line from this movie to Robert Altman movies. And I think that became a trademark of Robert Altman.
Oh, sure, I think
he even took it up another notch. But there's I mean, he had to have been influenced by this film.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Eric, you and I talked about The Big Sleep, you know, a few months ago, and they're certainly overlapping dialogue, especially in the scenes with Bogart and Bacall in that movie. So it really became a trademark of the Hawks stable. But he's a celebrated director of that time, but he's an underrated director. I don't think people think of Hawks in the same way that they think of Hitchcock or Billy Wilder or people like that. But I mean, he rarely made a wrong move.
Well, and I think part of that is because if you look at this movie, if you look at The Big Sleep, there's good cinematography, but there's nothing that is sort of outrageous in the direction that you're like, that's groundbreaking.
Right.
But I did notice in this movie, there are these real subtle camera shifts that move with the dialogue that makes you even think that this movie's going faster than it is. And it's a real subtle thing that he did that is a choice that he probably doesn't get enough credit for.
Well, yeah.
This place, I tell you, is just, this podcast.
I know,
wild.
We're taking notes. We're taking
I
learned
so much over here at Classics.
Well, yeah, and the final confrontation with Earl Williams when the sheriff finally knows he's in there and they release it, it's like, I don't know how many cuts it is, but it must be almost 20 cuts where they jump from person to person.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And the movie just speeds up. It was going fast at one point, but like they just put the gas on, and then the movie never slows down at that point. It just goes right up until the end.
Yeah. So great editing in this movie that gets you to those jump cuts. So excellent piece of film work there on the editing side too.
One question before we get to sort of wrap up stuff, is there anything that doesn't work for you in this movie? I mean, we talked about the African-American aspect of it, but any other thing that doesn't work?
The only thing for me was with Molly. I had just wished that she hadn't jumped out the window. And I'm sure this is more, I'm from a different generation situation, but it just seems so sudden. And like, it's like, gosh, lady, I know you're upset. I know life is unfair, but jumping out the window for these guys, like, this is not how you get back at them.
I kind of thought it was for her, you know, it was for Earl. It was for Earl, because she was trying to, I'll change the subject. I know that he's under, you know, he's in the desk, and I'll give you something to write about, you know, but it's still very dramatic.
Right? Because the reporters all ran down there to.
Right. She's alive, and they all leave. You know, I'm going, okay. Yeah, sorry, Vanessa.
But it's more.
That helps explain it. And I just, but as just a viewer, just of watching this, and I've watched it a few times now. But each time, I was like, "Huh, I just don't know why she's doing this." I mean, and you're right; they do all run away, but it just seems like, ouch.
Seems kind of more like a Shakespearean move when the rest of this is grounded in more of a contemporary reality.
And since so much of it is so comedic. That was just seemed like so sad to me. And I just was like, oh, wow, this is sudden. But that does help explain it. Thanks, guys.
Well, sure. And she lived, so it wasn't that sad.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. They didn't remake His Girl Friday, but they remade The Front Page again in 1974 with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau. And they cast a young Susan Sarandon as Lemmon's fiance in that film. And then Carol Burnett plays Molly Malloy in that movie. And Carol Burnett has gone on record saying it was her worst moment ever on screen.
Wow.
So, but it did. I think His Girl Friday improved upon the source material so
much
that going back to The Front Page just doesn't work anymore.
Well, I watched them back to back. I watched when I saw that it was based on The Front Page. I had a familiarity with The Front Page, but I hadn't ever watched it. So I wanted to watch it, and I'm like going, oh no, this is no, His Girl Friday is so much better.
It is.
Criterion Collection.
Sorry. Well, and that,
those are my opinions.
Yeah, well, and that original 31 movie of The Front Page was groundbreaking and, you know, did what it was meant to do. But okay. Hawks just improved upon it so much. And the movie was a huge hit when it was released, got great reviews. The amazing thing is not a single Oscar nomination, which is just crazy to me. And I would have thought, because this was a time when the Oscars did honor comedy a little bit more, but another movie came out that same year that you mentioned, Brett, The Philadelphia Story. And so that was...
my favorite movie of all
And The Philadelphia Story is less slapsticky, which might be why it got all, and plus you had Hepburn and Jimmy Stewart in that as well, which sort of raised the pedigree of that.
Gosh, 1939 and 1940. My gosh, those are years for films.
40 is a great year too. I think it's underreported, but 40, you had The Philadelphia Story, you had this movie, you had Pinocchio, you had Rebecca. So many great movies in 1940.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, more to watch, Vanessa.
I don't think I could ever spend enough time to catch up to Brandon and Eric. I think I'm just gonna have to stick with like Finding Nemo at this point. So
no, you've learned that you love this, so now you can join on in and the water's fine. You can just keep swimming in classics now.
Wow, nice pull.
And then, but although in 1993 it was added to the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress, and then the American Film Institute named it number 19 on the list of the 100 funniest films of all time.
Wow, so, that's good.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's good. Philadelphia Story was number 15. So.
Even better. Sorry, I don't know which I like. Oh gosh,
I know they're both
good.
Have
to watch them back to back.
They're both good.
Anyway,
they're both good. Yeah. So as we sort of wrap up here, I will start with Eric. Final thoughts on His Girl Friday.
Yeah. A unique, fast paced screwball comedy with this level of depth makes it a must see. So go out and it's in the public domain now, too. So it's real easy to find this one. And again, a very special thank you to Aaron Van Tassel for suggesting that we do this one. It was great fun to see it again. We know it's one of her favorite movies. I think a lot more people will be turned on to it because of this. So thank you.
Yeah. Vanessa, final thoughts.
Well, I don't know what these other 18 films are on this list, but this is a number one comedy to me. And it should be a required watch for anyone who's wanting to do any kind of comedy work, whether I could definitely see stage actors needing to watch this, because the delivery is so spot on, the rhythm, the timing, the speed, those are all things that I think can be observed and learned from watching this film. And it's just a really good film. I mean, I honestly don't know that I would have watched it had you not suggested it, but now I just want to watch more of these films because this was so good.
Awesome. Brett?
I'm bookending my thoughts. I'm like going, wow, this is a new favorite. I'm like going, I can't wait to watch it again. And I've already just watched it two times. I want to watch it again. I love this film.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's there's something I always say that people who need to get sort of an entryway into classic films, I either start them with Hitchcock or I start them with these kind of screwball comedies because they just seem fresher nowadays. And yeah, it's a great movie. And it requires multiple viewings. And I have some people who are used to, I don't know, some people who are used to less dialogue-driven movies today might be taken aback at the beginning because it's just so many words coming at you. But I think if you last about 15 minutes, you get caught up in the world, and then it becomes you're speaking the language after that.
Mm-hmm. And, I agree.
If you like Gilmore Girls, I think you would like this movie.
Very much so,
Amy Sherman-Palladino had to have been inspired by this, too. There's so many.
For sure.
But I do think Coen Brothers Brothers fans would enjoy this, which are, you know, often dialogue driven movies. And Quentin Tarantino was mentioned earlier. You're not going to get the violence in something like this, but certainly the dialogue is up there with
you. Got the violence. You got a suicide.
Well, yeah, you know? I stay corrected. You're right. Yeah,
sorry. But yeah.
Gunfire and an execution. So maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, and it's very, and it happens out of nowhere, and it completely changes the pace of everything. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, sorry.
And and two great stars at the peak of their powers. I mean, it doesn't get any better than Cary Grant for me, and Rosalind Russell, you know, just goes toe to toe with him in this movie. And you're right, Eric. It's her movie. I think he's in the first act and he's in the third act, and I think he's in like a small conversation in the second act, and that's it. So it really is her movie, and it's something to behold. And I think for any fans of comedy, this is one that you need to watch, just because so much comes from it. So as we get ready to wrap up and look forward to what's ahead, Brett or Vanessa, what's coming up on Beyond the Mouse?
Well, this is where we have Craig talk.
Yes.
What's coming up?
Craig, honestly, please.
We have so much that's coming up, but we've been really ahead of the game, knowing our spring's going to be busy. So we've already recorded episodes that are taking us into April, which will get to our 100th episode, actually.
Wow.
And we're hoping to have, if we can manage to get everyone's schedules just right, to have a few stars joining us. But either way, we're going to be celebrating our 100th episode in April. So we're really excited about that. And also, I think, Brett, I think we do need to say that while it's been fun here on Classics, we are happy to go back to our good old pal Craig.
Yeah. Of course.
We do love him so.
You know.
We tease him a little bit too harshly.
No, we go to Disneyland without him, and now we do this podcast without him.
I know.
But he loves us, right? I mean, we love him.
Exactly. So, Craig, if you're listening, we'll see you real soon, pal.
Yes.
And Craig's going to be joining us in June to talk Streetcar Named Desire. So he will.
Oh, without the two of you. So,
oh, no. Yeah. Oh, no.
He gets the rebuttal.
No. We hate Tim. We hate everything about Tim. Just kidding.
Well, Eric.
He's doing this without us. He didn't even ask. Vanessa. Is this allowed?
I don't know.
Okay.
And for those who haven't seen it, there's a great video interview that Beyond the Mouse did that came out probably, it'll be 2 or 3 weeks old by the time this hits the feed. But with the full-fledged movie star, Evangeline Lilly. So go check that out. Very, very, very good interview with her. Yeah.
Well, thank you. She was amazing. She was so nice. And we have so many wonderful takeaways and life lessons. So, and like we do today, watch more classic films. Hello.
Yeah. Eric, what do we have coming up?
We've got an exciting slate scheduled for March. We're going to do the wonderful George C. Scott movie Patton with our good friend Jay Hoffman. We're going to get into, I'm sure, his take on how the military is represented in that film. And one of the great all-time performances with that speech, Patton's speech. Mm-hmm. So really looking forward to talking about that one. And then after that, we're going to get more into our sort of subgenres. Because Patton will be our main feed show, correct, Brandon? Uh-huh. And then on our classics feed for March, you'll be able to get the Western High Noon. So, we went right to probably the top rated Western movie of all time. But this is the first time I think we're going to do a full fledged Western. So tune in for that.
Can I tell you something funny about High Noon?
Yeah.
Okay, in Eastern Europe, because I know some people there, they call it, the translation is, at the top of the hour. Wow. Yeah.
Perfect.
And Red River, translated, the river is red. So there you go.
That's great.
They love their country westerns over in
That's
Eastern
great.
Europe.
Yeah. That's great. And then just kind of a tease, I think, Eric, I think April is going to be one of our biggest months ever, because we're going to talk about three Best Picture winners that month. One of them, we're going to be joined by a very special guest. And I think I can say it now. We're going to be joined by our friend Patricia Ward Kelly, and we're going to talk about the 70th anniversary of An American in Paris with her. So we're really excited for that. And then, and then we'll also be talking about Ben-Hur that month. And then we're also going to talk about the movie that won our Best Picture audience poll a few weeks ago, Gigi. So, so three Best Picture winners, all from MGM. So that'll be
Gigi. I'm going to have to listen to that episode, because someone's going to have to explain to me that movie, because there's things happening.
Yeah.
And I'm going to need Uncle Brandon and Uncle Eric to explain some things to me on this film. What's that
movie called in Eastern Europe?
Gigi, I guess. I don't know. I'll ask.
So a lot of fun stuff coming up on all of our shows. So just check all of our feeds. You can find us all on our Facebook groups. You can find us on Instagram at FRN Classics Pod. If you want to request an episode like His Girl Friday did, you can email us at classicsfrn@gmail.com. So if you request one, we'll do it, as long as it's made before 1980. Otherwise, the Flashbacks crew come after us. But
yeah.
I am in line for City Slickers. So everyone else, you're just going to have to wait till somebody does a review of City Slickers. Okay, wait your turn. Take a number.
Well, Brett, Vanessa, I got to say, it's been a blast having you guys on. You guys have an open invitation anytime. And so does Craig.
I was hoping for that. Oh, my
gosh.
We
need to discuss that, Brandon. We'll see.
He
didn't even ask us, Vanessa. I know he's a big boy, he can do what he wants, but he didn't even talk to us. Truth be told, we didn't ask him either.
So Eric and I'll confer and make sure that we don't step on anybody's toes.
I'm not doing City Slickers, is all I'm saying.
No.
Come on.
We'll save that for Lutons. We'll save that for Lutons.
All right. I'll talk to Ryan.
Awesome. So as we conclude this episode of Front Row Classics, I am Brandon.
And I'm Eric.
And I'm Brett.
And we will see you in the front row.
I'm Vanessa.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.